everyone, and welcome back to the Strike and Ellicott Files, an unofficial podcast dedicated to all things Cormoran Strike and Robin Ellicott, as written by Robert Galbraith. My name is Kenz.
I'm Lindsay.
And I'm Pools.
And today we'll be continuing our reread of The Running Grave, covering chapters 83 through 87 of Part 6. Please be aware, as always, that our discussion of The Running Grave will often reference the ending of this book, as well as the previous books in the series. But before we get started, we have news.
We have new news?
We have new news.
Nice.
So let's start with the Ink Black Heart news first.
Okay.
This bit that I'm going to start out with first is, I think, one of the most exciting bits of news.
Is it, though?
Well, I mean, as far as the Ink Black Heart stuff.
I mean, it's, you know.
It's pretty exciting.
It's him.
Yeah, yeah. So if you don't know what we're talking about, we found out who's going to be playing Murphy in the Ink Black Heart adaptation, and it's going to be Stephen Hagen, so very exciting. And his first name, instead of being Ryan, it's going to be Richard instead, so he'll be DCI Richard Murphy.
Richard. He's literally a dick.
That's exactly. I'm so glad I'm not the only one going for that low-hanging fruit.
Well, listen, if Jane Austen made the joke, then that means I can make the joke and it's not low-hanging fruit, because that was one of Jane Austen's best jokes in Persuasion, that Richard had done little more than to earn his nickname of dick. So that's a classic literature joke. Not lowbrow. I'm allowed to make it. Continue.
And he looks great.
He's literally perfect. When I saw his face, it was just an immediate, that's him. That's Murphy.
I'm so ready to be annoyed by him.
We liked him in Ink Black Heart.
We did.
It's hard to remember that
far
back.
How the turntables.
Yeah. It was wonderful to hear from our friends who got to meet him that he was very kind and chatted with them. And from what I've seen on Twitter, he seems to have a good sense of humor about the fact that we're all going to have to hate him out of pure loyalty. Kidding. I'm just kidding. Of course, we won't hate him.
No.
If you follow him on social media, please give him a very kind welcome to our intense little fandom. I can't imagine a more perfect casting.
Yeah, he looks absolutely perfect for the part. And he seems like a really great guy. So thinking maybe he and Care Logan can share tips.
Yes, I would love that. Because Care Logan's my favorite.
We love him. And his mom.
Yes, and his brother.
The whole family.
Next up, we found out who the actress is going to be for Edie, and that's Miran Mack.
Yeah, I don't think it's actually confirmed, but it's pretty. It's pretty clear.
That's who that is, yeah.
There are pictures of her standing outside the office looking for help, right? It's very obvious that it's probably Edie.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, it's so sad to see him. Just like, someone help her.
Oh my God. As soon as I saw that yellow phone case, it was just like a gut punch.
Oh. I love that they have such small details like that included. Like, the color of her phone case is correct, you know?
Mm-hmm.
What else?
All right. Next, we have Emma Fielding. So we had been talking about that we think that she was going to be playing Katya.
Were we right?
We were right. She's playing Katya Epcott. So yay. Got that right.
I think that's a couple we've gotten right now.
Mm-hmm.
Right. The other one was what? Grant Ledwell.
Yes.
We have even more casting news, right?
Yes, we do. This is really exciting. So we found out that Christabel Ross is going to be featured in the adaptation, and she's going to be played by Marnie Graham Maugh. And if you don't remember who that character is, that's the eldest daughter of Jago Ross and his first wife.
Yeah.
And it's just super exciting to know that they're including the storyline.
Yeah, I didn't expect the daughter, because we don't really see much of her in the book except on social media, right? So it's exciting to see where they're going to go with it.
Yeah, maybe they're going to like show the video that Midge gets and stuff like that. So.
Or show her on like her Instagram posts, videos. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Maybe she'll post a video instead of a Reddit post about her abusive.
That seems very likely.
Does anyone have any guesses on whether or not they're going to use the same actor from Silkworm for casting Jago this time?
I wouldn't think so. Do you mean from the one photo that was in the magazine?
Mm-hmm.
I don't even remember that.
Yeah, they show like a photo of him and Charlotte on the cover. Yeah. I would think that it would be like with Leda, because they show a picture of her and Cuckoo's Calling, but I don't think that's the same actress.
No.
Next, outside of any casting news, there's been a lot of filming going on, and there was some filming going on in Denmark Street, which was really exciting. Some of our friends over on Twitter were able to watch that, and a few other people. They got to see the bombing and sort of the aftermath of that. There's some footage of Robin and Murphy walking towards each other, and then Strike walking into the office with an overnight bag.
Yeah, that must have been such a fun day to see. It's so interesting that they film all of the shots in one day. And an overnight bag, that must be a Madeline implication. And also, it seems like maybe Joe was on set recently, because she posted these amazing pictures of Ink Black Heart merchandise.
I love those.
Oh, those were great. Yeah, there's like a couple of shirts in the picture, I think. There's one that has the Ink Black Heart logo, and then there's one that's like a drawing sort of thing where it's got Hardy and the worm, and they're all standing in Highgate with their backs facing the viewer, and then they're facing Paperwhite and Lord and Lady Wardygrab.
Mm.
And then there's a collectible Drek figurine, and then that giant plush version of Hardy, which I desperately want.
Yes! Oh my God.
So cute.
I would pay so much money for that Hardy. His sad little face. I want to squish him. I wonder who gets to keep all those props after filming, because I do really want to keep them.
They should donate them to us.
Yes, to me.
You personally.
I want the Hardy. So soon.
I know. The Hardy's so cute. It seems likely to me. And I think this is what a lot of people are speculating, that this must be for a Comic-Con scene.
Yeah.
It'll be all set up at an Ink Black Heart booth.
Yeah, those pictures definitely scream Comic-Con to me. I'm really hoping that we'll get to see Strike as Darth Vader, because that would be so much fun.
Yes.
I can't remember who said this a while ago, but would they have to get an okay for him to wear a Darth Vader costume?
Maybe.
Someone suggested maybe. It might be easier to have him dress up as Drek.
Oh, yeah, it would be, but less fun. I can see them doing that, though.
Yeah.
So the last thing as far as Ink Black Heart filming was, we saw some pictures that were of them doing the filming from the Ship and Shovel and then in Highgate, which is really exciting. So that means we're going to get to see, I think, that fight between Thurzaz and Strike.
Oh.
And then whatever, you know, all the scenes that we get in Highgate. So
I bet those scenes are going to be amazing.
Moving on off of filming news, though, on April 2nd, Jo mentioned on Twitter that she finished a chapter that day and that Strike and Robin are in cold and rainy London in February 2017, specifically Cricklewood, which sounds like an area that they're probably going to be doing an interview in.
Cricklewood. That's such a good neighborhood name, isn't it?
Cricklewood.
She was writing while on vacation.
We appreciate her dedication.
We do.
Yeah.
Must be pretty good if she's writing through a vacation.
Oh, it's a good bit.
Could be.
I love it. It's a good sign, because if she's getting to the good bits, she's not going to be able to stop. So this is a good sign for us. If she's riding in some tropical beach somewhere, I think that's a very good sign.
I think we can somewhat safely assume she's getting towards the end of the book.
Yeah, she's
right. So
right.
They're still in February 2017, which means that shorter timeline that we're all hoping for is starting to seem really plausible.
Oh my God, I hope so.
Yeah.
If it's February 2017 and that's towards the end of the book, that would mean that the time scale is what, like 5-ish months?
Mm-hmm. That's exactly what it would be. The Running Grave ends in late September, which is 5 months exactly. I love this because it means we probably won't have a huge time skip. And it might mean like a more compressed, faster paced case too.
Yeah.
So the 5 months is roughly the same time from his Ink Black Heart covered, because that book was about 5-ish months from Edie being murdered to them solving the case, right? Although in Ink Black Heart, that time frame came after this long summary of like the 4 months between Troubled Blood and Edie's murder.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So that means either there's a much smaller time to be sort of glossed over in summary, and the case is much quicker, or we just dive right into the new case, which I would love.
Either option seems
either option. Great. I'm happy.
I'm excited about this potential timeline. Yeah, I'm also interested in what the shorter timeline could mean for Sark, because is it going to be a situation like in Troubled Blood where they can't find someone and realize this person has moved to Sark and go to interview them?
I mean, that seems plausible to me, because I feel like Sark feels like the kind of place where you could just kind of disappear from the outside world.
Well, if you ever disappear, that's the first place I'm looking.
Oh no, you know of my desire to fake my death to avoid commitments.
Yeah, I do. You've mentioned it many times.
You're not going to trust any obituaries from me.
No. I'll need to see the body.
Yeah, that's smart.
We have more exciting news, though, don't we? Because J.K. Rowling updated her Twitter header again. This time, no one even asked. She just did it.
Yeah, she sure did. It's this really stunning shot of Creef up in Scotland. So, so pretty.
Mm-hmm.
I have to say, something that I'm starting to get really curious about is the Freemason connection that we've talked about before, because now she's put up at least 3 different locations that are connected to them in some way. So there's the Freemasons Hall in London, there's La Coupée in Sark, which happens to have a Grand Lodge nearby in Guernsey, and then Creef, which just happens to have a lodge there as well. And then there's them being in Cricklewood, and that's a part of London that has a lodge that meets a few times a year at the Freemasons Hall that was Joe's first header.
Hmm.
It's a lot of places that happen to have either lodges or halls or something.
Okay, so you're saying that there are Freemason halls in connection with all of the other clues, right, that she's posted?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Are there a lot of Freemason halls around so that this isn't necessarily a coincidence? or are there not that many and it is a coincidence? Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I hear you. As far as major lodges in the UK, there's like 16 major ones. There's one in Scotland and then there's 15 other ones that are scattered throughout the UK.
So it's not like there's hundreds and yeah. Everywhere she's posting is probably going to have
yeah,
one.
Yeah, it's not like every single city has a Masons Lodge. So I think that there's a possibility.
There's a connection.
That there's a connection between all of them.
Okay, that's interesting.
Yeah, I think that could be intriguing. Yeah. And then touching on the Hallmark thing, while I was looking this up, I noticed that there's these things called Masons marks that are supposed to be these unique engraved symbols that, again, I'm not an expert, just reading stuff off of Wikipedia. So if there's anybody who knows better, feel free to.
Well, I think that makes you an expert.
I'm now a Freemason's expert.
Do you think we have any Masons who listen to us?
We might have people whose brothers or uncles or.
That seems more likely. I don't think we have a huge male audience.
We have some. We definitely have some.
Kurt. Are you a Mason?
That's a secret.
Anyway, as I was saying, I'm not an expert, but there are these Freemasons who take what's called a degree of Markmaster Masons. They have their own unique markings that they have to create specifically. Each person who has that degree has to make their own. Not that I think that Strike and Robin are going to take down the Freemasons or anything, but I think it's possible that the victim might be one, or maybe is branded or tattooed with a symbol or something.
That's interesting.
It just reminds me a lot of the carvings, you know, the White Horse of Effington carvings on Chisel's Gallows from Lethal White.
Yeah.
Yeah, the marks.
I agree about them probably not taking down a whole organization, but I like the idea of the victim being one, or maybe a suspect could be one or something. I definitely see the argument that this is more of a tie-in than just the location than what we were first thinking.
You know, until like 2009, there was a law in the UK that if you were a Mason and you're a cop or a judge, you had to announce that you were a Mason. Then they got rid of that law so you could secretly be a cop and a Mason and you wouldn't have to tell anybody.
When you say telling people, are you talking about the same way that like sex offenders have to like, yeah, you know, say well, that I'm just imagining people going door to door. I'm a Freemason.
I think you have to like make a declaration, like do a form.
Did they announce it in the paper with the obituaries and marriages and shit?
Probably within your work organization, like the police.
Yeah, yes. It had to be declared, but then it no longer had to be after 2009. So I'm just saying that a cop.
I know what you're just saying.
You know what I'm saying. Could explain someone's meteoric rise to DCI.
Maybe his father is a Mason.
Is there a lodge in, what's the place where his sister lives?
In San Sebastian? Oh, dear God. All right. You know what?
Now I'm Googling. San Sebastian Freemason connections.
I don't think his father lives in San Sebastian.
No.
We haven't heard anything about his parents, have we?
No.
No, not yet.
Where are they?
Maybe he killed them.
Exactly.
Because he's so evil. Please sense my heavy sarcasm.
I couldn't sense it.
Going back to the header, though, do you think that she's just showing a general photo of the city, or are we meant to focus on this hotel? Which, by the way, I thought was a castle at first, but it's the Creef Hydro Luxury Hotel, right?
Yeah, and what a beautiful hotel it is.
Oh my gosh, it looks like a gorgeous actual castle.
And very popular with families, and has lots of kids' activities and stuff.
Oh, fun. So are we getting two trips in this book?
I was really worried that it was where Murphy was going to take Robin, especially the kids thing. He's like, oh, look at how great all these kids are. Don't you want some? But it's a really, I think it's too long a drive for a weekend getaway. Thank God.
Also, again, I don't think that she's going to give us that in a header.
He's not important enough for a header.
But so, yeah, someone's going to Scotland.
Yeah, I think we know for sure that Strike and Robin are going to Sark, but I really hope that they're both going to Scotland too.
That would be so much fun. A book of road trips and enforced closeness, making things awkward for them and fun for us, would be so great.
Yeah, I mean, that's what makes sense. After a book of enforced distance, a book where they're crammed together in cars constantly and hotel rooms, etc.
Can we go back to Troubled Blood and the kissing swan towels? Because there was a theory about those swan towels in Scotland, right? I can't remember if it was you, Pools, or if it was Anna Chiara who said this first.
Oh,
it's been a while.
Yeah, it has been. It sounds like something insane that I would say. And it was connected to Scotland because the kissing swan towels were in the room called Loch Nagar. So we theorized that Strike and Robin would have their real kiss on some mountain in Scotland, or so the theory went.
I actually went and looked at our notes for this chapter.
Oh, yeah.
because I couldn't remember. Here's the line from Troubled Blood. He'd hoped Lochnagar might be on the first floor, but he was disappointed. It lay, as the name might have suggested, right at the top of the B&B and faced out of the rear of the building. So you were suggesting that this could either foreshadow a trip to Scotland or a case for the royal family, since the mountain is on the Balmoral estate. I didn't see anything about a kiss in the note, so either you added that in or Anna Kiara heard the theory and added on the kissing swans. But if they do go to Scotland, it might be in the back of my mind just a little bit.
All right. Should we get into the Q&A?
Yes.
Q&A.
Throughout the series, Robin has faced many personal and professional challenges. How does her journey continue to unfold in this book?
When we meet Robin in this book, she's now in a stable, happy relationship with her CID officer, Ryan Murphy. Which Strike, of course, hates. So she's in a very different place emotionally, and yet she still wants to go undercover, which potentially means a separation of weeks or months, because she, like Strike, is putting the job first. And that in itself probably represents the single biggest, not change exactly, but over the course of these seven books, we've seen Robin turn into someone who prioritizes investigation over her private life. That was something she really struggled with in the first couple of years with the agency because she had a very unsupportive partner. But now she's really quite clear, this is what I am, this is what I do. And, you know, if you want to be with me, you will accept that. I think we see her in this book absolutely come into her own. Her resourcefulness and her resilience are exemplary. I certainly couldn't do what she did. But I think she does an amazing job in this book.
You know, I always love it when Joe talks about them like they're real. Mm-hmm. Robin does do an amazing job in this book, but you have done an amazing job with Robin, Joe.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. It's been such a joy reading about Robin being that 25-year-old newly engaged to Matthew, finding her dream job, looking up to Strike, and then becoming every bit as impressive as he is.
She has. We're so proud of this fictional 31-year-old woman. So proud. I love that Joe says she's come into her own, because she has. I think there's, like you said, every bit as impressive as Strike. There's zero question that she and Strike aren't equals. They are absolutely equals in terms of investigative power at this point. I think they have different strengths that complement each other, but they're on the same plane, and they have been now for some time. And it's so good.
That's why they're such a good pair.
Yeah.
You know, it's making me think about what we talked about with Strike starting out as that loner detective that's very noir and typical. We talked about how Joe is changing that, where he's healing and growing and moving away from it, but Robin's kind of the opposite, right? She starts out as committed to this other person and this other life, but longing to pursue her passion. And now she's kind of grown into not a loner, but someone who's putting work first and holding Murphy at arm's length. They just have the opposite kind of journeys, but they're going to end up in the same place with each other.
I like that. I'm side-eyeing the bit in this question where Joe says that Robin's in a happy relationship with Murphy.
So
I'm like,
says who?
Would we call that happy?
Right.
Seems like a bit of a strong descriptor for a relationship that has some really fundamental cracks in its foundation. Like, she's in love with someone else.
I think that's one of the, I'm not giving away anything.
Yeah.
We're going to say this, but yeah.
She's contentish enough.
Not actively unhappy.
Not actively miserable yet.
All right. Chapter 83. In chapter 83, Strike receives a call from Midge and waits for Robin outside of Chapman Farm. So the epigraph for this chapter: 9 in the 5th place, in the midst of the greatest obstructions, friends come. And that is from Hexagram 39, Obstruction.
I think there are a couple layers to this one. First and foremost, most importantly, Robin is currently facing her greatest obstruction during her time at the UHC, which doesn't feel like a strong enough word for what she's actually facing. But her friend, her best friend, has come for her.
And thank fuck for that.
But I also see this as Strike facing a great obstruction where he doesn't know what's happened to Robin or what to do. And Midge is there on the other end of the phone. She offers him company if he needs it, and they both apologize. So both Strike and Robin have friends there for them in this very dark moment.
I completely agree. Just as a fun side note, The image for this hexagram says, a dangerous abyss lying before us and a steep, inaccessible mountain rising behind us, which is just where Robin is, right? There's an abyss right in front of her that she's being dragged into, and then her mountain of a man is waiting for her at her back. She can't get to him yet, but he's there.
So this is a very, very short chapter. We see Strike arriving at Lion's Mouth at 1 o'clock in the afternoon, with Mitch calling at nearly midnight. And then it says 6 hours later that she still hadn't appeared.
Yeah. So did Strike sit there waiting for Robin from 1 o'clock in the afternoon until 6 a.m.? 16 hours?
That's so confusing for me, though, because in chapter 85, he can't stay in the vicinity of Chapman Farm by daylight because he'll be caught. So he has to go back to the hotel, right?
Yeah.
So it doesn't make sense to me that he'd be sitting there in the afternoon in chapter 83. The only way I can make this work is if he'd actually arrived in like Aylmerton or something in the afternoon, met up with Dev and booked his hotel.
But does all of their initial surveillance of Lion's Mouth, where they were finding the blind spot, was that all at night? Did they do all of that at night? I didn't have that impression.
They might have like driven by during the day or briefly parked, but maybe it's the risk of just sitting there parked all afternoon. Maybe.
Yeah, that's real soulmate shit right there. That is a long time to not only be sat waiting, and we know Strike is a man of action, so this has got to be killing him.
Yeah.
But a lot of times just be sat there waiting and hoping and praying that nothing bad has happened to Robin. I'm anxious on his behalf, and I know how this ends.
And I mean, even if it's not 16 hours and he is only there in the dark, that's still all night. That is a long time. That long sitting in the car, because you wouldn't really be able to get out and stretch, would you? You know that he's keeping his eyes on the forest focused 100% of the time just to make sure he doesn't miss Robin. Like, there's no scrolling the news or cat naps or Candy Crush to pass the time here. No, he is watching for her. That is a long night.
Just so we're perfectly clear, because sometimes it gets mixed up in my head, when Strike arrives that afternoon, that's the day of the manifestation, right? That we've already read with Robin. So while he's sitting there is when she almost drowns and is then placed in the box.
Yeah, that's right. Oh, can you imagine if he knew? Like, if he's known that she was in a box and he was sitting there, he'd be climbing over the fence and storming in there to,
he'd be whacking everybody with wire cutters.
He'd be bringing his wire cutters and putting them to very good use.
I love it when it says that he had sent Dev home because there was no need for them to both sit there. Realistically, it could have been good to have two of them there because they don't really know what they're up against, right? But of course, Dev can't be there.
No.
We can't have long holding each other sessions in the car and Strike kissing the top of her head with Dev around to be a third wheel and kill the vibe. He's got to go.
Exactly. We would have had to break out the spray bottle.
Yes. Yeah. Let's back up to Midge's call, though. I'm assuming she's primarily calling to check in on Robin. I bet they all would have been checking in during this time that he's sitting there, Pat included. I'm sure everyone is just panicking and so worried.
Yeah, I think that that's what Strike is referring to whenever he says to Robin that everyone's been crapping themselves about her.
Yeah. And like I said earlier with the epigraph, Midge offers Strike company. I have to give Midge some credit here. It isn't a small offer. This is almost a 3-hour drive and it's midnight.
Oof.
But she's offering to come up and sit with him so he isn't worrying alone.
This was a really endearing moment for me with Midge. And especially hearing you describe it here, that's a very kind, generous offer that she's making. It's really sweet how much she cares about Robin. And I like to think that she can tell how much Strike cares about Robin too.
She can't be there either, though.
No.
No.
No, she can't.
She also gets the spray bottle.
I'll spray her extra time just for my own fun.
I don't think it will surprise anyone to know that I love this bit because, you know, I love Midge. I feel like if Midge had driven up to join him, I bet she'd have been climbing over that fence by 4 a.m. to try to find Robin, as impulsive as she is. I mean, just a hunch. She could have persuaded Strike to let her like sneak in and do some recon because he is very worried at this point. Mm-hmm. And she too is a woman of action. She'd want to do something. She's got the legs for it.
You mean just two?
Yeah, two.
I don't know if that would be the best move.
It would be a terrible move. I'm just saying that together they might have gone for it.
It says with an aim of maintaining these friendlier relations with Midge, Strike asks how Tasha is.
I quite like this because he's not asking how the surveillance went or if the Franks showed themselves, but how Tasha herself is doing. He's clearly doing it because he knows that Midge likes her, that they've got a little romance forming, and he's being touchy-feely with the staff. He's learned from Robin. It's growth.
The phrase touchy-feely still feels so wrong to me in that context. It just makes me think he's like honking her boobs or something. Like that's That's what that means to me.
Yeah.
I wish you'd get touchy-feely with
other people. I could go for some honking there, yeah. Oh my God. Okay, so I kind of enjoyed the apologies these two give each other. Says, I might have overreacted with the photos. Didn't want to give Patterson another stick to beat us with. I know, said Midge. And I'm sorry for what I said about her with the fake tits. Apology accepted. I like that it seems, to me at least, that Midge understands why he was upset about the photos. Now that she seems to have calmed down, I think her I know means that she gets it. And it did actually make me laugh and roll my eyes a little bit that even in her apology, she still says her with the fake tits.
I feel like it's probably best that the agency doesn't have an HR department yet, because I can only imagine what that meeting would have been like otherwise.
Strike and HR would be like Michael and Toby, only less ridiculous.
Sworn enemies. Oh, that's funny. For me reading this, I felt like this exchange of, as you said, apologies. It showed to me how alike these two are at their core. Because Strike admits he overreacts, but he's not going to say, I'm sorry. And Midge does say sorry, but at the same time, like you said, is calling Bijou her with the fake tits. I just feel like they're both striking the same tone with these apologies. They're not going super overboard with it, just the bare minimum apology. They understand each other's language and their type of apologies because they're speaking like the same apology language here.
Yeah, I don't see them as being as similar as you do.
No.
No. I can see what Joe says about them being both being direct, but yeah. I like directness.
Mm-hmm.
I think they have things in common, but I don't think they're the same at their core. They seem so different to me because they have such different energies about them.
Mm.
Strike seems like he would be pretty chill to be around most of the time. Midge feels like she's always on and it would drain me. They just seem very different personalities to me.
Interesting.
And yeah, it's no secret I don't love Midge. I don't hate her either. This is a good Midge chapter. Of course, it's about a page long. You know how Joe said that Shanker's good in small bits? I can handle Midge in small bits when she's being nice.
I feel like once Midge gets off the phone here, she's at home just Googling the fastest way to buy a rainbow of tracksuits for an infiltration of her own. If she had the right color of tracksuit and she could see it from what the people at the temple are wearing, I bet she could just sort of sneak in through the field. And if she looks important and self-assured, like she's supposed to be there, people might just assume she was one of the Americans or a visiting member.
You think there's that many people that they wouldn't notice a totally new person?
Well, not for a little while. There are at least 100 people living there. It's the social engineering. It's all about looking like you belong and no one's going to question you, right? As long as you don't run into Wace or Mazu, you're probably going to be okay.
Or Tayo or Jang. I would be so terrified of all of a sudden going from one woman that you've lost to.
Yeah, I think Midge would be up for trying it.
Yeah, I feel like if they were to break in, they would at least need to call Murphy or Wardle, have some sort of law enforcement backup.
If Robin hadn't showed up, what would they have done?
That I would have bet call Wardle.
Yeah, but luckily they didn't have to, I guess.
Yeah, so the chapter ends with, when Midge had hung up, Strike continued to stare through the night vision binoculars at the woods. 6 hours later, Robin still hadn't appeared.
Because she's locked in the box.
I mean, as stressful as this is, my excitement level was very high reading this because I knew we were here. I knew whatever was going to happen in the next few chapters would be Strike taking her away from this place, and it was going to be amazing.
Yeah, little did we know how amazing it was going to be, right? Let's keep going so we can get closer to it.
Okay, chapter 84.
All right, Robin is charged with taking care of a dying child named Jacob.
And the epigraph, 6 in the 5th place, persistently ill and still does not die. And that's hexagram 16, enthusiasm. It seems clear to me that this is about Jacob. Although there's something about it that makes me think of the UHC as a whole. It's been this horribly sick place for so long and it still hasn't died yet.
I get the same feeling, and it does seem to be pointing straight at Jacob. I was looking for other meanings in the hexagram itself. I'm coming up a bit empty because this hexagram enthusiasm, as a whole, it would seem to relate very much to Wace's control over the members of the UHC and the feelings of devotion that he inspires in them.
I remember that earlier one where they were all crying for him and throwing a party.
Yeah, exactly. So that's the enthusiasm. But for this specific line, the judgment read, a man is under constant pressure, which prevents him from breathing freely. However, this pressure has its advantages. It prevents him from consuming his powers in empty enthusiasm. Thus, constant pressure can actually serve to keep one alive, which does seem kind of relevant to this chapter, if it's the him in that is Robin, because when you think about how Robin is at her lowest point, right? She's at the moment where she's so afraid. She's ready to comply, ready to seek approval, ready to sort of be subsumed into this horrible false enthusiasm. But then at that point, she sees that embodiment of the illness that slaps her in the face, and it provides that pressure to snap out of that spell of compliance and sort of save her life.
Mm-hmm.
But that's a reach.
The opening paragraph of this chapter is one of the hardest parts of the book to read. Reading about the pain Robin is suffering inside the box, that she's forced to urinate in there, and that she's imagining herself dying all alone in there.
Yeah.
It's hard to read about anyone in that situation, let alone someone we all love as much as we love her. But mm-hmm. I do remember noting that the top of the box was scratching her back anytime mm-hmm. she moved, and realizing that the mark she'd seen on other people during her time there must have been from this. It definitely helped a little bit, because I remember thinking, okay, she is going to be let out. Other people have been through it. She's going to get through this. But it must have been the longest 8 hours of her entire life.
Well, I mean, it was the longest paragraph of my life.
Yeah.
So definitely the longest 8 hours of hers. But can we talk about how there's no chance that she wasn't thinking about Margot Bamborough during those 8 hours? When she says she imagined dying locked inside the box inside this locked room, she was remembering finding Margot's body crammed into that ottoman, right? The image must have come to her mind.
Yeah, I definitely see the parallel here where there's women inside a box or ottoman. I can see her thinking something like, is someone going to find my bones in 40 years if I die here?
Oh my God.
But I imagine she would have also been thinking about a lot of other things, like what she should have done differently, what she's going to do afterwards.
Did she think about Strike?
I'm sure.
What did she think about him? Tell us, Joe.
You know who she didn't probably think about?
Who?
It's you a mystery. Know.
Midge.
No. Well, yeah, maybe not.
Robin's finally let out by Hattie, who, if you can't remember, is the woman who checked her in when she first arrived at Chapman Farm.
I think we talked about this when we first arrived at Chapman Farm, that there are certain things bookending her time there. Like, she reads a newspaper when they stop on their drive up, and now she's reading newspapers in the room with Jacob. And we also see Hattie on her first and last days, but we never see Hattie any other time.
You know what? I don't remember talking about that. But now that mm-hmm. you say this, yes. Oh my gosh.
I promise we did.
Yeah, I believe you. And Hattie's gone from smiling to stony face now.
Hattie being smiling in the beginning and now stony faced, it does really work for the UHC as a whole, right? Because when you first go in, it's all smiles, all this fake appearance. And then now she's getting the actual real stony faced behind the scenes look.
Yeah.
It really reflects the phony image of the UHC versus the horrible truth of it.
Yeah, the facade has dropped.
And then, of course, another bookend that we talked about was the color blue. So she arrived at Chapman Farm with blue in her hair. And now on the very last day, she's given a blue tracksuit.
And she's about to be rescued by a certain Mr. Cormoran Blue.
Should we go over the blue thing again just a bit? Yeah. I know it's possible we're seeing significance where there might not be any, but it feels like there's such an importance placed on blue for these two.
Oh, there is. I'm fully on board with it. I don't think we're reading too much into it at all. And I mean, Robin's middle name is also a shade of blue. Venetian blue is a thing. It's a real connection.
We've said before that it feels like blue gives her strength. You know, it gives her that connection to Strike. Before she realized she could talk to him in her head, her hair had the blue. The chapter after it was removed, that's when she started talking to him. And now here in this chapter where she's lost all hope, she's put in blue until she regains that real connection with him.
Aww.
And the blue tracksuit also helps her as she's running through the forest, because it's harder for Tayo and Jang to see.
Yeah.
It's a little bit of protection that it gives her, maybe just like the hair did.
It is.
As much as I hate to, let's read this next part.
Nothing mattered to her now except the approval of the church principals. Terror of the box would be with her forever. All she wanted was to not be punished. She was now scared of somebody from the agency arriving to get her out, because if they did so, Robin might be shut up in the box again and hidden away. She wanted to be left where she was. She dreaded the agency endangering her safety further. Perhaps sometime in the future, when she'd recovered her nerve and round-the-clock surveillance had been lifted from her, she might find a way to break free, but she couldn't think that far ahead today. She must comply. Compliance was the only safety.
Oh, this was, to me, the saddest part of the book. It's probably the saddest part of the whole series for me.
Mm-hmm.
I'm so glad and thankful that this doesn't last more than just this chapter, not even that much. But the thought of Robin Staying in this cult without the purpose of being undercover, but just out of fear, is devastating. Reading that she didn't want anyone from the agency to come for her, I wanted to break down and cry. It was so sad.
It's awful, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Little does she know she's going to be out of there so soon. It's okay, Robin.
It's like, even though I'm the one who gets frustrated with Robin when she argues about safety in other books, you know, yeah. She doesn't want to stay home or go to a hotel when terrorists are after her, and she fights with Strike about it. But the fact that that fight is gone from her now is heartbreaking. They've stripped her of herself. The real Robin would never comply with this. And like we said the last time we saw Will, it makes his behavior and the behavior of other people so much more understandable when you realize that so many of them must also just be complying out of fear.
Yeah, it really does. If the box can affect somebody as strong and mentally resilient as Robin, I can only imagine how effective it is at keeping anyone else there scared into submission.
Oh, yeah.
Anyway, Robin is then told that she's going to be looking after Jacob.
I feel like there's something about her being led once again through the dragon carved doors, up those scarlet carpeted stairs and past more black doors. I'm not really sure what I'm thinking. All the doors reminds me of Harry dreaming about the Department of Mysteries, but that's not a real connection.
It felt to me like she's walking into the dragon's mouth. Is that a thing? Or like the dragon's cave? She's being led to the deepest, most corrupted little corner of the heart of this horrible cult.
Yeah.
And then the fact that when they reach that top floor, all of the shiny polish is gone. It's just an uncarpeted hallway, a plain wood door. There's filth and pain and disgusting smells, which reminds me a bit of the disgusting decor in the retreat rooms, which is also the gross heart at the middle of this, stripped of all its shininess.
I'm literally imagining her like the little magic school bus going inside a dragon to the hearts, because it works, you know?
It works. Drinking
that. She's going to the heart of it. That might be more actually correct than anything having to do with the dragon carvings or anything. It's like what I was talking about with Hattie. Literally everything that's shiny and pretty has now completely been stripped away. She's getting the worst behind the scenes look at the absolute truth of this place. And it's not the nice carpet or the peacock blue walls or the friendly smiles. It's a woman locked in a box. It's people being held underwater. It's rape. It's a helpless child being starved to death in a dirty old attic and his mother being forced to watch it happen.
Oof. Yeah.
Maybe another bookend, right? It's we see the best on that first day, and now we're seeing just the absolute worst.
Yeah.
So when Robin enters the room where Jacob is kept, Louise is sitting there with him. And this is just terribly sad to know that this woman is sitting there with her child, watching him suffer and dying, and knowing that he could probably be helped if they weren't trapped there or allowed to leave.
I can't get past the absolute evil of the Waces making this woman hold vigil like this over her child that they are killing. It's just so gratuitously cruel. Like, is this part of her punishment, being made to do this?
Maybe.
It's horrific.
Yeah, I can't imagine how painful it must be for her. Especially when she doubles over and she starts screaming. I mean, this is horrible to read.
The amount of guilt that she has to be living with on a day-to-day basis, and especially like once the farm is raided and everything, has to be enormous.
I was wondering if this is one of the reasons Louise keeps being punished or isn't allowed to regrow her hair, because of the grief she's clearly displaying for her son, which, as we all know, they see as wrong.
Yep.
It makes me think of my all-time favorite line from Harry Potter. It's when Harry's digging the grave for Dobby and he's finally able to push Voldemort out of his mind. Mm. And it says, grief, it seemed, drove Voldemort out, though Dumbledore, of course, would have said that it was love.
I love that line.
Me too.
So meanwhile, the UHC would call that ego motivity.
Ugh.
Yeah.
So evil.
Oh, can you imagine how absolutely epic it would be to see the Waces have to face Dumbledore? Like, remember when he tells off, remember when he tells off the Dursleys? It was so amazing.
Oh, that was so good.
The damage you've done to your son.
Yes. Ooh.
Oh, that was so amazing.
Yeah, it's clear that Louise loves Jacob, because after she tells Robin what to do, it says, to Robin's surprise, she pressed her fingers to her mouth, kissed them, then placed them gently on Jacob's forehead. Then in silence, she left the room.
Robin's reaction to Louise in this scene is another glaring sign of that grip the cult has on her, because we get this absolutely pitiful description of Louise's physical state and her clear anguish. And then it says, had she broken down at any other time, Robin would have felt more compassion than impatience, but all she cared about at this moment was to avoid any more scrutiny or punishment. Robin without compassion, Robin in the face of suffering, caring only about her own safety. That's not our Robin. this is what the cult has done to her.
Yeah, I mean, it makes sense. I'd be terrified too. Mm-hmm. So Robin thinks that Jacob's on the brink of death. We know that he dies soon after this, right? It seems rather unlikely to me that he just so happens to die right when Robin escapes and they realize the police might come.
Yeah, I see where this thought train is headed and I'm on board with it.
Yeah, I know it's awful, but in my head, the first thing Wace would have done when he found out Robin escaped was to send someone in to kill Jacob so that they could bury him and get rid of the evidence. It wouldn't take much. I'm imagining it's just like the pillow dream in Trouble Blood with Satchel's sister.
Yeah. That seems more likely than him just so happening to die right after Robin leaves.
I mean, I know that he is going to die either way. Mm-hmm. And Robin saying he's on the brink of death might suggest that it's almost time, but it's coincidence.
They definitely hurried it along a little bit.
I think so, yeah.
So Robin then correctly realizes that the reason that she's been tasked with looking after Jacob to begin with is to make her complicit in his death.
Yeah, this still seems legally like a stretch to me because it's no one's fault except for the Waces. But I guess if people believe they're part of something, that fear will keep them quiet.
Exactly. And it doesn't matter whether or not it's true, just whether or not you can get people to believe that it is.
Very much a parallel to Abigail with what she held over Cherie and Jordan, except they were much more guilty than anyone who looked after Jacob would ever be.
Much more.
But also Robin doesn't stay quiet about this. This is the thing that she immediately goes to the police about. And the thing that starts to bring her back to herself. They picked the wrong person to look after Jacob.
They really did. They done fucked up here because being faced with someone who's vulnerable and suffering at the hands of monsters, that is the one thing that would be absolutely guaranteed to push Robin past fear into action. Look back to Career of Evil, where she was so determined to help a little girl who was being raped by a pedophile that she lost her job. That was her whole identity. And she lost the friendship that was the prize of her life. She did that to save a little girl. She's willing to run into a house with a machete wielding incel to save his little sister. So you think this is going to scare her into silence? You don't know Robin Ellicott, and Artemis the Hunter is coming to fuck you up.
Can we just take a moment before we move to the next point to appreciate the prize of her lifeline?
Prize of her life. I put that in just because I wanted to remember it.
The prize of her life.
The friendship that was the prize of her life. And she didn't even know she was in love with him yet at that point.
I remember reading that and just dying.
Yeah, being like, oh my God. So I had to slip that in.
Yeah, I haven't gushed over the Lethal White prologue since the last time we recorded, so it was time. Do we know who else has looked after Jacob? Because there'll be people that Wace wants control over, right? I know Shauna did. Did Penny?
Yeah, Penny was helping look after Jacob. So Penny, Emily, Louise, Shauna, I guess. I'd imagine that generally they'd give this job to the more beaten down or, you know, just not the brightest women at the farm, because it is such a horrible thing that I don't think they'd want to risk anyone who is too intelligent or not super blindly loyal on this. Although it does seem to be a bit of a punishment for Louise.
Oh yeah, definitely.
I think they counted on the box breaking Rowena enough that she'd comply and then be complicit, but that felt like sort of an opportunity they took for her rather than like this is the typical assignment for difficult members to get leverage over them. I know they do that generally with to make people complicit, but God, this is just such a horrible thing.
The chapter ends with Robin quietly starting to chant and then stopping herself thinking, I mustn't go mad. I mustn't go mad.
Oh.
She hasn't chanted in a while, right?
No.
It seems like she's lost the ability to talk to strike in her head and keep her from chanting, which is why I think she's wearing blue. All right, do we need a cult chapter cleanse?
Absolutely.
I think this is the last one. I don't think we need any more.
Oh, thank God.
After this one. Okay, so I have another line from a previous book that I really, really want to come back. And it's part of the vow bit from Lethal White.
Oh, it's related to the vow? Let's hear it.
I mean, I think we know that one thing that Robin is really stuck on is what Strike wants, right? Mm-hmm. I think she understands that there's an attraction there, that he might have certain feelings, but that he doesn't want anything with her, right? But what is one of the best parts of the vow is when he says to himself, he wouldn't say it unless he knew that it was the woman he wanted to build his life with. I want to know if he is going to say those words out loud to Robin. Like, if she asks him, well, what do you want? Imagine if he said, I want to build my life with you, or I want to build my whole life with you, because they've already built half their life together.
For these two, that's a bit more than half their psychoalics. I've already built 80% with you. Yeah.
But do you know what I mean? Like, I can actually see him saying that to her.
Yeah, he needs to know like the magnitude of what it is that he said to her. It's not like he's ever said that to anybody else aside from Charlotte.
Yeah, I think that he knows it. She knows what he wants. She needs to know. And I feel like those particular words are important and really could come back. I feel like he could say it to her and I would die.
In all of my imagined conversations and my, you know, those words come in. Absolutely.
He says it. I could see it and I want it. I think it's important. I think Robin needs to know.
Because that's what she's afraid of, right? That he doesn't want that kind of permanence. Yeah. He needs to set her fears at ease and that's the perfect way to do it.
Although I still wonder if Robin will put herself out there before fully knowing and risk it like he's risked things.
Yeah.
But at some point, it would be fantastic if he told her that. Mm-hmm. And she'd be like, okay, let's do it.
Exactly like that.
When she realizes the full extent of how completely crazy and love strike is with her, like the depth of his feelings for her,
she's going to spontaneously combust just like all of us will.
I mean, I'm about to combust just thinking about it. She is going to be absolutely gobsmacked by this because she has no idea.
I can imagine some laughing through tears.
Oh, she's going to cry. Oh, she's going to cry 100%.
I think he might cry.
Oh,
which would be, okay, amazing.
Oh, strike even tears.
Better.
I love it when he cries.
Which sounds terrible, but...
No, you know what I mean? Because I love seeing the emotion from him and the vulnerability. Yeah,
I get it. Me too. I'm hoping for some tears in the next book.
Tears of happiness. All right. Are we cleansed?
I'm cleansed. It's like I've just had a green tea enema for my soul.
Wow.
I didn't realize your soul had a butthole. Anyway, moving on.
Chapter 85.
In this chapter, Strike receives intel from Shanker about Jordan Rini's phone call.
The epigraph for this chapter reads, patience in the highest sense means putting brakes on strength. And that's from hexagram 64, before completion.
I think this is saying that Strike could break through that fence. He could storm the castle, throw his weight around, punch anyone who gets in his way until he finds Robin. But that might actually put her in more danger if she was hidden away and he couldn't get to her. So he has to be patient and just keep waiting.
Man, what a pity keeping all of that strength held back. I would like to see it.
He's saving it for holding Robin.
Yes, I can't.
You don't want to tire the arms. Yeah.
I've got to keep his arms at full strength. But yeah, you're right. He's got to wait. Right after this bit, the hexagram says, therefore, he must not fall asleep and lose sight of the goal. If he remains strong and steadfast in his resolve, all goes well in the end. This is actually just a little funny to me because there's no risk of him falling asleep in this chapter. He literally can't fall asleep.
Please tell me that I'm not the only one who had this experience when reading the opening paragraph of this chapter. So it talks about how Strike checked himself into a hotel and wanted to get a few hours of sleep, but even he, who is usually able to sleep anywhere, just could not sleep. And it says, even when lying on the four-poster bed, just like Robin knows that Strike is there in the upcoming chapter, I too knew that Strike and Robin were about to sleep in this bed together. I knew it. That bed is being mentioned for a reason.
It's Chekhov's bed. Chekhov's bed.
I was so excited. Mm-hmm. Oh my God.
Speaking of the description of the room though, when it says that there's a ceramic stag head over the mantelpiece, is it crazy of me to see this as a little nod to Harry's Patronus? You know, making this room a safe, protected place for Robin to flee from the Dementors. Is that crazy?
Maybe. Maybe, but I don't ever think that I'll be able to hear the word stag and not think of Harry. So,
right?
Of course, my mind did similar things here too.
Yeah.
If we were doing like word association and someone said stag, I would say Harry.
Patronus.
Or Patronus. Yeah.
Same.
Not to bring us down or anything, but all of Strike's worries are completely valid.
I'm worried about them too, even though, you know, I already know what's happened.
Yeah.
This little list of anxiety, Googling satellite maps, I'm feeling it.
He's worried that she's been identified as a private detective and is now being held hostage. Oof. I don't know if I ever fully appreciated until this reread how close we are to this actually happening. Mm-hmm. I had predicted that her cover was going to be blown before we got the book, and I previously said that I got this wrong, but it was only barely wrong because Wace does suspect her. Mm-hmm. If Robin hadn't escaped, Will wouldn't have followed. How long would it have taken him to tell them what he knew and just confirmed what they already suspected?
Not long, especially if they threatened him.
Yeah, with the box.
No, that's so funny because that stood out to me on this reread as well. honestly, I think I was so stressed when I was reading this for the first time that it didn't even register with me. But God, what a terrifying thought.
Or maybe they start researching private detectives. It's not like she hasn't been in the news. We know her picture has been taken going into court before. I don't think it would have taken much longer for this to have actually happened.
It would have been like that scene from the TV version of Lethal White when Jimmy Knight looks her up.
Yeah, exactly.
So anxious.
Shrike also thinks of the other UHC centers where they could just claim she's gone to. And he thinks that she could be the next Deirdre Doherty, where there's just never any sign of her again.
And this is extra horrifying when you realize that last night she almost did become the next Deirdre Doherty. Yeah. She almost drowned in that pool. Her body would have been buried in the field and Shrike would have never seen her again and never known what happened to her.
I know. This is why I tend to think that had she been discovered, they might have killed her or considered it. Because it would be very easy to just say she left, or we sent her to Birmingham and she escaped. We have no idea where she is, you know, especially if they realized who she was and the kind of influence she might have against them on the outside.
Oh my God, I'm getting stressed and this doesn't even happen.
I know, it's okay. None of it happened. We're so close to sharing a bed.
so close. Ooh, okay. All right, moving on. While Strike is worrying about Robin, he gets a call from Shanker with an update on who called Jordan Rini pretending to be his wife.
It says the caller, who we know was Abigail, arranged for a time where she could call Rini because she didn't want to give her return number for him to call her back.
Imagine that.
Yeah, weird. It says that the number she called from had an area code that covered Cromer, Lion's Mouth, Aylmerton, and even the lodge he was currently sitting in. I immediately fell for this thinking, well, it must be the UHC, when in reality, if it had been them, I bet they would have done the exact same thing and disguised their number or called from somewhere else too.
They'd have spoofed it. I was like, the lodge he was sitting in, I was like, the call is coming from inside the hotel. The
lodge. Yeah.
My God, it was Strike the whole time. But yeah, I thought the exact same thing as you, that it was definitely the UHC. And what we should have been looking at was who on the outside would want to make it look like the UHC and would have the knowledge needed to do that.
Yeah, exactly. By the way, I did look this up because Shanker says that Strike owes him a monkey. Mm-hmm. And then Strike says, all right, the monkey's yours. Obviously, from context, I understood it meant money, but I did want to know why they called it that.
Mm.
So Google says that this is London slang for £500. It says, while this London-centric slang is entirely British, it actually stems from 19th century India. The British Empire's control of India led to a number of phrases making their way across from the Raj to our shores, with monkey perhaps the most famous. Referring to £500, this term is derived from the Indian 500 rupee note of that era, which featured a monkey on one side. Although the ape has since been replaced, the phrase lives on.
That's really interesting.
Yeah, now I'm just thinking about that bit from the beginning of Silkworm when Strike is explaining this to Robin and her response to him asking what they call 500 quid in Yorkshire. And she says, shockingly little to stab a teenager.
Yes. Okay. I forgot that that was in Silkworm.
Yeah, it makes me laugh every time.
But we didn't know that cool information about the origin before. I like learning that.
Today I learned.
So the chapter ends with this line. Having removed a few cushions, Strike sat down on the sofa, vaping, drinking tea, and willing the hours to pass quickly so he could return to Chapman Farm. This is so sweet.
It really is. This just has to be killing him here.
I know.
Being stuck in a position where he can't do anything. Like, don't worry, bud. You're going to get to see Robin so soon.
I know. So soon. Especially he can't even make a plan. He has no idea what he's going to be able to do.
He just has to wait.
I can't imagine the anxiety that he's feeling.
Terrible.
All right, chapter 86.
In chapter 86, Robin speaks privately with Emily and gathers important information from her. And then the epigraph, 6 in the 4th place means waiting in blood, get out of the pit. And that is from hexagram 5, waiting nourishment.
The idea of waiting in blood feels so appropriate for being in the UHC and what Robin has witnessed. I don't know if it's going to make sense, but the phrase having blood on your hands when someone's guilty comes to mind. Because Robin has been waiting in and has been a witness to their guilt. At one point, she's literally not waiting, but wading in Lynn's blood, right?
Yeah.
And now she's seeing Jacob, which she thinks is the most horrific thing she's seen. And in this chapter is when she knows it's time to get out. It's time to go. It's time to run.
Time to get out of the pit. I cheered when I read that part because that is a direct command from the I Ching to Robin right there.
Get out of the pit.
The judgment for this line reads, "The situation is extremely dangerous. It is of the utmost gravity now, a matter of life and death," which is very accurate. And how horribly ironic is it that this is the nourishment hexagram when she's being forced to sit next to a child, that this place is literally starving to death.
Yeah.
The hexagram says, "The gift of food comes in its own time, and for this one must wait. It's not coming for Jacob because of these people."
The first couple of paragraphs are about how Robin has been taking care of Jacob and how she's so tired that she's almost falling asleep in the chair. So she starts reading the newspapers that are covering the floor.
This is the first time that Robin in 4 months has spent in this cult. One, not being surveilled and having to constantly act like Rowena. And two, being able to just sit with her own thoughts, right? I mean, I know that Jacob's here and she's having to care for him and it's terrifying and a horrible day, but there's also a sense of stillness here that feels like it's an opportunity for Robin to sort of gather herself back to herself, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, I do. Jacob isn't a prying eye. He's not dangerous. No. He might not even be aware of anything that's going on.
So for all intents and purposes, she's basically alone.
It says that reading the news made her feel her isolation even more while also pulling her back towards the real world.
Now, two contradictory impulses battled inside her. The first was allied to her exhaustion. It urged caution and compliance and urged her to chant to drive everything else from her mind. It recalled the dreadful hours in the box and whispered that the Waces were capable of worse than that if she broke any more rules. But the second asked her how she could return to her daily tasks, knowing that a small boy was being slowly starved to death behind the farmhouse walls. It reminded her that she'd managed to slip out of the dormitory at night many times without being caught. It urged her to take the risk one more time and escape.
I'm so glad that the rock bottom she's at right after she left the box is already starting to lift. We're seeing Robin come back to us. I think the news from the real world plus seeing Jacob was a reminder of what she was there to do. This grounded her. It let her rise above the fear.
Robin's resilience is breathtaking to read here. How she manages to keep it together after everything that she's just gone through is nothing short of incredible. Robin is exceptional.
And mostly it's because someone else was in more danger than she was. Seeing Jacob brought Robin fully back, because we know she cannot sit back and do nothing while someone suffers. She's incapable of not doing everything she can to help, including putting her own safety at risk.
It's almost like she's got a little bit of a saving people thing.
Almost. I don't know if I'm weird, but I was so excited when Robin read the news about Charlotte's suicide.
Oh, no, same. I was like, oh, is that
Me now?
I feel like if there's any news from the outside that would act like a shot of adrenaline to Robin's arm, waking her up, this would be it, right?
Exactly. It was going to be this news that she knows would be devastating for Strike, the most important person in her life.
It grounds her back into reality and into Strike, her touchstone.
Yes.
Plus, she's got to get back and gossip with Ilsa about it.
One more thing. It says that Robin was trying to read this in the fading light. So we know the sun is setting, and thinking back to Strike, he had been waiting for the sun to go down so he can go back and wait for her. It's almost time. We're almost there.
Yes. Oh my goodness. All right, let's do it. Getting back into it, Robin drops the newspaper when there's a knock at the door and then Emily comes in.
Oh, I feel so bad for Emily that they threatened her with the box if she didn't tell them about Robin giving her the money.
I'm really impressed by Emily that it took the threat of the box to get her to admit to Rowena helping her. One of the basic tactics of cults and authoritarian governments is to encourage members to spy and report on other members, right? We see it under the information control section of Hassan's bite model, and we've seen it in action in this book. And it's peak efficiency. You don't have to pay for prison guards when the prisoners themselves do the job. And it discourages individual bonds and loyalties, which is absolutely what this cult wants. But back to my point, for Emily to not only not tell on Rowena, but to refuse to admit what happened until she's threatened with torture, to me shows an incredible resistance to the cult's control. For someone who spent her whole life in this environment, she's very strong for doing that.
So this is when Emily tells her she can go. Jang is waiting downstairs. What it says, something strange happened. She suddenly knew, didn't guess or hope, but knew that Strike had just arrived beside the blind spot at the perimeter fence. The conviction was so strong that it stopped her in her tracks.
Thigh break.
I know.
It's my favorite part.
Yeah, this is the moment that reminded so many people of Jane Eyre.
Yes. Yeah, yes. I gasped the first time I read this because instantly, it's Rochester. Pretty sure I mentioned it in our reaction episode, right?
Yeah, I remember.
Have we described the actual moment in Jane Eyre that we're talking about yet on the podcast?
I don't know.
I don't know if we have, but just in case anyone listening hasn't read Jane Eyre, this comes near the end of the novel. So Jane is about to give in to St. John, aka Murphy's, pressure to marry him and go to India against all of her principles, all of her feelings. But she's weakened. She's about to give in. And then it says, I saw nothing, but I heard a voice somewhere cry, Jane, 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 and nothing more. Oh God, what is it? I gasped. I might have said, where is it? For it did not seem in the room, nor in the house, nor in the garden. It did not come out of the air, nor from under the earth, nor from overhead. I had heard it. Where and whence, forever impossible to know, and it was the voice of a human being, a known, loved, well-remembered voice, that of Edward Fairfax Rochester, and it spoke in pain and woe, wildly, eerily, urgently. I'm coming, I cried, wait for me. Oh, I will come. But so that's the moment. She's many miles away, but in this moment of spiritual connection, she hears him. Later, she says, this is not deception or witchcraft. It's the work of nature. She was roused and did no miracle but her best. And then later at the end of the novel, when Jane and Rochester are reunited, because she goes to him immediately after this, he tells his own story of the same moment. And in it, he says that where he is buried in the forest. The sound is dull, but the where are you that he heard seemed to have been spoken amongst mountains. For I heard a hillside echo repeat the words. I could have deemed that in some wild lone scene, I and Jane were meeting in spirit. I believe we must have met. And the parallel here that struck so many people is that in both cases, the heroine is at her greatest extremity, her weakest moment, a moment of great danger. And then there's an experience of spiritual connection that has no rational explanation. For Jane, it's hearing Rochester's voice calling for her. For Robin, it's knowing that Strike has just arrived, as if she can see him through the forest. And it's this moment that gives them the strength to leave, to run, to find the man they love. It's just so goddamn romantic. So romantic. Anyway, also another significance here. So Robin is stuck in the attic in this chapter and discovers the death of Strike's wife, ex-fiance. Ah. But in Jane Eyre, the reunion could only happen once the wife that he kept in his attic... Not great. Right. Advertisement for Rochester there had died, committed suicide and burned the place down. And until Rochester himself had been struck down, humbled by that fire.
Has anyone made the comparison between Charlotte and what's her
Bertha?
Name?
Bertha? Yeah, Bertha Mason.
Charlotte is Bertha.
I think that there have been, because you can definitely see a couple parallels there.
Yeah.
But yeah, women stuck in attics is a thing. And then, you know, there's St. John Rivers and Ryan Murphy, the parallels lurking in the background. For both of these moments.
I remember when I was first reading Jane Eyre and I was messaging you complaining about him.
Yeah.
Saying that he was giving me Murphy vibes with the whole, this is what I want for the future thing.
Big Murphy vibes. Yep. Good looking. Oh, yeah. Smart guy. Yeah.
Yes. That was my impression too.
Also, I'm kind of interested in what Jane says, that this is not magic, but nature doing her best. And I can't quite articulate why.
Yeah, no, I know what you mean, because magic with air quotes is what the UHC performs. It's not real. It's not truth. It's not good. Nature is something tangible and real. And this connection between both couples is real too.
Yeah.
It also takes me back to chapter 64 and Strike in the Church, where he thinks that there are some things that just can't be explained. You can't find the answer because there is no explanation. Her heart just knows he's there.
Oh, yes. You're so right. It's not magic. It is, even if we can't explain it, it's part of the natural world. It's real. And I mean, we can come up with explanations, like Robin's subconscious has connected night falling, knowing she's two nights late, knowing what Strike's reaction would be, and coming to the conclusion that he's there without her consciously knowing why. But in the end, it's not how she knows that matters. It's the connection between them. It's her faith in him.
Yeah. And you know what? I wouldn't find that less romantic. Nope. If she knew he was there because he said he'd be, then you're right. Her faith in him, that he'd stick to his word and be there, is a whole other reason to swoon.
This moment gives me the goosebumps, the shivers.
Full body chills.
Full body chills on this spirit connection between them. Like you say, Kenz, that's some soulmate shit right there.
Real soulmate shit.
Yeah.
Robin turns back to Emily and then gets down to business by asking her some questions.
This interrogation where I was like, yes, that is my Robin. That's my badass girl boss. She's back.
I know. And I like that there's this little parenthesis a little later that says again that she knows Strike is there. She knows this is it. This is her final chance to get information. And yes. Robin Ellicott fully re-entered the farmhouse. She's going to get that information and run towards Strike and towards freedom.
Yeah, I love how she reiterates that he was there, that she had a conviction that he was there. It went beyond what she could see. And was just straight into faith.
Talking about faith is interesting because it's like in a book where all of these people have faith in the wrong thing and in these false prophets and the UHC. What's real is her faith in Strike.
Yep. So the first thing that she asks is who Jacob's parents are.
I love that she asks this question, though, because she knows she has seconds to ask everything she needs to ask. But she starts with this. And I think it's because she wants to have as much information as possible to give to the police because she has to do something to try and help him.
Oh, I hadn't thought about this way, but you're totally right, because getting help for Jacob is her top priority.
Yeah.
So yeah, get who's legally responsible for him.
Yeah, get the information.
Who is he?
Yep, that's what she's doing.
The next thing she asks is, what did you mean when you told me Dayu did forbidden things at the farm?
I love when Emily resists. We get that little parenthetical reminder about what's giving Robin her confidence, just to reiterate, Strike's there. But then we get her saying, you owe me. To get the information she needs. Mm. She is taking her leverage and she is applying it ruthlessly, and it's pretty badass.
You know,
she has, like Joe said in that listener quote, she has come into her own as a detective here.
Emily says Dayu used to sneak off during lessons and would get sweets and toys. I'm trying to remember how all this connects.
I think it's that Abigail was the one grooming / bribing her with sweets.
To get her to trust her.
Yeah, which makes she was doing magic with other people who were pure spirit very creepy. Because what was Abigail doing with this toddler in the woods and barns? I don't like it.
I'm getting the ick.
Whatever it was not good.
She then asks Emily to tell her why she said Dayu didn't drown.
Emily said that Dayu had told her that she was going away to live with Cherie. Mm-hmm. And of course, Emily doesn't say Cherie's name. Robin did. And I think that Robin, having this knowledge of Cherie and knowing about the invisibility, must have clued Emily into something. Mm-hmm. I know this is an assumption, but I feel like the authority Robin is speaking with during this conversation and the knowledge she had would have given the impression to Emily that something was happening, that the person in front of her wasn't who she said she was, but in a good way, she still trusts her, but something is different about the way that Robin is speaking to her here.
Yeah, definitely. That was the vibe that I got as well, because Emily might not have known exactly what was going on at this particular moment, but she's catching on.
My heart breaks a bit for Emily when she talks about Cherie. She says, I was so jealous. We all really loved Cherie. She was like a real, like what they'd call a mother. Emily had a real mother who brought her into this cult and then let their familial bond be severed and basically ruined Emily's life. And, you know, I'm kind of not at all surprised that Emily never wants to see her again.
That line reminds me of Goblet of Fire when Molly hugs Harry and it says that he had never been hugged like this as if by a mother.
Oh my God. Aww. Oh, you have to break my heart with that one.
Yeah, that line kills me.
About that.
Yeah, I'm not surprised that Emily doesn't want to speak to Louise either, but I have a lot of compassion for Louise.
Yeah.
I think we've said it about 1,000 times during these cult chapters that Strike and Robin could have never been prepared the way they needed to be because they just had no idea what they were actually facing with her coming into this cult. And that's with them knowing it's a cult, knowing it's dangerous, knowing the accusations. Mm-hmm. Someone like Louise, who is maybe just lost and looking for something, would have had no idea what she was getting herself into. And I highly doubt that if she would have known then what she knows now, that she'd still make the same choices.
Yeah,
I understand how a child, even an adult one, might feel that way. But I just can't blame people for not knowing what they couldn't have known.
Mm-hmm.
Louise and her circumstance, just it hits me hard because I think that all parents worry that the choices that they make are going to screw up their kids.
Yeah,
I worry about that all the time. Reading about Louise is like reading about my worst nightmare. You know, a choice that she made led to the death of two of her children and then to the estrangement from her other two that we know of.
Yeah.
And she has absolutely no power or the ability to try and change it. I just feel so sorry for her.
Yeah, that's really brutal.
When Robin asks her to explain the invisibility, this is when Emily explains that Cherie had given them special drinks to make them sleepy, but because she didn't drink hers, she saw Cherie helping Dayu out of the window before Cherie went back to bed.
I've said before that I have complicated feelings about Cherie. I know that you don't have a lot of free will in the UHC. So I know Cherie was forced to do things that she wouldn't have normally done, but I still don't know how you hand off a child to be murdered and then just go lay down and go to bed. It's hard for me.
I'm betting that she pretended to herself as hard as she possibly could that it was a joke or a prank and that Abigail wasn't actually going to kill Dayu. She made herself believe it. Her fear was stronger than the drive to protect. She was no Robin.
It's like what Robin thinks earlier, that she can no longer comply the way her fear wanted her to, because now she knows about Jacob and she, Robin, can't just pretend she doesn't know. Cherie could have told someone. She could have said no to Abigail. She could have tried to protect Dayu.
Robin's last question is if Emily ever told Kevin what she saw. Yes, said Emily. Later, ages later, when I told Becca I'd seen Cherie helping Dayu out of the window, she said, "You didn't see that. You can't have done. If you couldn't see Dayu in her bed, it was because she can turn invisible."
Yeah, of course, we know this is the start of the Drowned Prophet and why Kevin was able to piece things together.
Yeah.
But then the questioning ends because Jang walks in, tells Robin it's time to go. Ooh. Yes, it is.
It is.
Should we go straight to 87?
In this chapter, Strike and Robin reunite and she escapes from the cult.
Yay.
That was so unenthusiastic.
I don't want to blow out the mic with my real emotions.
Yeah, I know. We don't want to damage anyone's ears.
Yes, exactly.
And the epigraph, 9 in the fourth place means then the companion comes and him you can trust. And that's from Hexagram 40, Deliverance.
And him you can trust. Can I melt any more over this epigraph? Like, oh my goodness, how appropriate for this chapter.
I cheered to myself when I read this for the first time. I could have cried with the relief I felt reading this epigraph because I knew they were about to be reunited, that Robin was about to escape, that this nightmare was over. Mm-hmm. But it's just so perfect. He is her companion, her partner, her best friend. It's him she can trust. It takes me back to that part of Troubled Blood that I know I'm always going on about, but her thinking of him in Lemington's Spa and how she could trust him on the big things. Mm-hmm. You know, Strike is a good man. He has flaws, but so does Robin. And he's an absolute saint compared to these men. An angel.
100%. Though you could say he's not a saint any more than she is, but he's a good person.
Yeah. Also, how perfect is it that the name of this hexagram is Deliverance?
So perfect. The hexagram itself reads, "Here the movement goes out of the sphere of danger. The obstacle has been removed. Difficulties are being resolved," which is true. And then this image really gets me. "Just as rain relieves atmospheric tension, making all the buds burst open, so a time of deliverance from burdensome pressure has a liberating and stimulating effect on life." Just the images of thunder over water, those are the trigrams, and the feeling of a thunderstorm cracking and finally relieving that heat and that pressure. It just feels so accurate to me for this moment.
All right, so let's get in. We haven't been as hard on Jang as we are on Tayo, because he's the less evil of the two, right? But when he averts his eyes from Jacob, his son, and then all he says is "that room stinks," it makes me wish that Strike had the chance to hit both Tayo and Jang in the face with those wire cutters.
Yeah, I'm going to need an alternative universe where that happens.
Just bam, bam. Yeah.
You know, next to Tayo, Jang has seemed like a better guy for sure. But if Jang had the power that Tayo has, would he behave any differently? Really?
No, absolutely not. He's only better than Tayo because he's not allowed to rape women. Yeah. But he would if he could.
I fully believe it as well. Yes.
Yep. I don't know if it's just me, but these two brothers have such different creepy vibes. They're both creepy, but the vibes are different. Tayo's the kind of creepy who thinks he's all that, flirts with you when you don't want him to, touches you.
Yeah.
Jang is the kind of creepy guy you realize is watching you with binoculars from the end of the street.
Oh my God.
You know?
I feel that. Different vibes. Both awful.
Both creepy, different kind of creepy.
You don't want either of them knowing where you live,
nope,
or your phone or anything about you. Don't want to be in the same room.
I don't want to be on the same planet with them.
Send them to Mars.
Robin wants to get out of the farmhouse as quickly as possible, but she doesn't make it out without one more encounter with Jonathan Wace.
I'm trying to imagine if he knew she was leaving and waiting to pounce, or if he just happened to bump into her. I don't know what I think it was.
I don't know either, but either I wanted to scream when he came out of that room. Leave her alone, man. She's got somewhere to be.
When he's like, "Are we friends again?" I'm like,
"You fuck off."
Yeah.
Seriously. Off you fuck.
Also, a fancy silk tracksuit. He just looks ridiculous.
He does. He is ridiculous. It is.
Silk tracksuit. Come on.
Yeah. So then Wace brings Tayo out and wants Robin to spirit bond with him before going to sleep. Ugh. I wasn't as panicked as I was a few chapters back because I knew she was about to run. The epigraph tells us it's about to be okay, but still, how annoying. How disgusting are these people to spring this on her after what she's just been through?
36 hours she's been awake, drowned, tortured, emotionally and physically, starved, and now it's the rotten cherry on the crap sundae. Here comes Rat again with his clammy little hands. No thank you.
Yeah, but this is their MO. The first time Tayo tried to sleep with her had been right after her revelation.
Yeah.
Another time where she had been really vulnerable and afraid.
God, I really hate him. What an awful man. You know, getting off on women's fear and vulnerability like this. Like, fuck the Lego field. This guy desperately needs the personal phallic amputation services of Cormorant Strike.
Agreed. Yes.
And just to continue with all the people I despise, Noli Seymour popping up in her leather pants and white t-shirt saying, lucky you, you get Tayo. If I wasn't spirit married, I'm like, please.
Oh, please. Yeah. I was like, yeah, that's easy to say, Noli, but yeah. I call bullshit on you.
Yeah. I need Carl Pilkington.
Bullshit man.
To fly in. Yes. Yeah. Like she'd ever give Tayo the time of day. Not that I blame her.
No.
But again, sitting by and letting these things happen is just something I can't understand. Yeah. Noli Seymour knows perfectly well that Rowena doesn't want to sleep with Tayo, but she's pretending it's all so great. It's just so disgusting to me.
Yeah. She's complicit. It's gross.
And then why do you think we get this final mention of Artemis here? It says, Robin heard Noli say, why do you call her Artemis? She missed Wace's answer in another outburst of laughter from the sitting room.
The laughter is there because so Wace thinks that he's finally going to dominate by proxy Artemis the Chaste. He's finally breaking through her final boundaries. He's conquered her. But you know what? In the end, we're the ones having the last laugh because Artemis the Hunter is about to break free and run through the woods to rain down hellfire arrows on these monstrous rapists.
Yeah, I love that interpretation.
So laugh now, Wace, because you're not going to be laughing much longer in prison.
I do love the idea that he's laughing, thinking he's won. He's defeated her.
That's what he's doing.
So here's the part where Tayo is pulling her to the retreat rooms and Robin says that she needs to use the restroom first.
So Jang knows that she supposedly just used the bathroom a few minutes before, and Robin is scared that he'll say so, but he doesn't. He sides with Robin and tells Tayo to let her pee.
Yeah.
It says just a little bit ago, too, that he looked sulky when Jonathan Wace told him to wait outside the retreat room door. So I think it's a combination of his bitterness of not being allowed in the retreat rooms, along with the rapport Robin was able to build with him that allows for this moment.
That rapport is like the one thing that it really saves her. God, between Emily and Jang, her ability to make friends with people and get through to people really is something that helps her out.
And I know I'm not the first to suggest it, but this is definitely a sort of Peter Pettigrew moment where the smallest hesitation, the smallest thing of getting someone on your side, even for a second, is the thing that allows you to escape. Mm-hmm. If only he too had been strangled to death by his own magical silver hand.
If only.
If only.
If only.
Silver. Hallmarked man. No.
Peter Pettigrew was the hallmarked man the whole time.
Okay, now I'm going to be looking for Peter Pettigrew parallels.
Maybe it means we're getting Peter Gillespie back. Just kidding.
That's such a good point.
I'm kidding.
I don't care if you're kidding. I love it. I'm going to run with it. Let me write this down so I don't forget.
Oh, God.
I go grab my tinfoil.
Yeah. All right, you guys, we're here. Let's go, Robin.
Robin pushed her way into the bathroom. Marion Huxley was bent over the sink, cleaning her teeth. In one fluid movement, Robin had stepped up onto the sink beside Marion, and before Marion could shout in surprise, had forced the window open, heaved herself up on the high sill, swung one leg over, and then, as Marion screamed, "What are you doing?" let herself fall, hitting the ground on the other side so hard she fell over. But she was up in an instant and running.
I think at this point, I am just screaming, yes, go, go, go. I mean, we're all cheering out loud at this point, right?
Totally.
And like I said before, it notes that her blue tracksuit was harder to see in the dark than the white. Because I think at first I thought that it was talking about how it would be harder for Strike to spot her, but that's not a problem because he has his night vision goggles. It's harder for Tayo and Jang to see her and catch her.
Exactly. And it's symbolic. It's her connection with Strike. He's hiding her. He's protecting her. She's out of the Drowned Prophet's grip now, out of the white.
And her weekly trips to the Rock gave her the advantage because she knew the woods so well. That connection she maintained with Strike via the letters is now another layer of protection and advantage.
Yes, exactly.
It's so weird that if people are free to leave, they have to chase after her and are screaming, get her. So weird.
It's so strange. Why would that be?
I don't understand it. But now I think the tears came for me when it says, and in the BMW, Strike saw her coming, throwing aside the night vision goggles and picking up the foot-long wire cutters. He left the car at a run. He'd got through three strands of barbed wire when Robin screamed, they're coming, help me. Something about her screaming, help me, to him is so heartbreaking because she doesn't need to ask for that from him. It's just this visceral reaction to scream for help.
She has to be so terrified.
I know, but he's there. He's there.
Man, there's just something I really love about this image of Strike just throwing aside the goggles and then just running full tilt towards Robin when he sees her, you know, wire cutters in hand, that I just really love. Go get the woman you love, Strike.
I know. And then he grabs her and pulls her over the fence with him, pushes her towards the car, telling her to go as he sees Tayo's shadow appear. I love that Strike doesn't also just go for the car. He has to hit this man. And we all needed this. I needed this.
Now that's what I call catharsis.
Yeah.
I mean, he can pretend that, you know, he needed to make sure that he stopped them so they wouldn't impede their escape. But yeah, I think we all know that something inside Strike was telling him that this asshole in particular deserves some wire cutters to the face.
Are we ready to close out the chapter?
Yes.
Robin had already started the engine. She saw Tayo rise again, but Strike was inside the car. He slammed his foot on the accelerator, and in an exhilarating burst of speed, they were driving away, Strike having found a glorious release for his days of anxiety, Robin shaking and sobbing in relief.
Oh, she's out, you guys. Strike has given Robin a t-shirt. Robin is free.
Oh, yay. Man.
Everyone take a sip of wine.
Yeah, cheers to Robin.
Can we please call this episode Robin is Free?
Yes.
It has to be spelled Robin is Free.
Yes, yeah. Absolutely. Yes.
Yeah. It'll be like one of those episode titles like Damn It, Barkley, where you know what's going to be going on before the episode even starts.
I know I don't even really need to ask, but what are we doing next time, Kent? People are going to kill us for stopping the episode right now.
Like, what? We're just getting to the good stuff. Yeah. So next episode, we are doing chapters 88 through 91. So in those chapters, Strike and Robin share a bed.
Yeah, they do.
Strike meets with Sir Colin for a case update, and Robin's parents visit her.
All right. Can't wait.
That'll do it for this episode. Thank you so much for listening. If you enjoy what you've heard, don't forget to follow us on social media. We're on Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr at The SE Files Pod. You can also contact us on our website at thesefilespod.com or email us directly at sefilespodcast@gmail.com. Thank you so much again for listening, and we hope to catch you next time for another episode of the Strike and Ellicott Files.